Hello there, and welcome to The Mindfield, the show where we try to explore the complex moral terrain of modern life and try not to blow ourselves up in the process, to be frank. I'm Scott Stevens. My co-host is in mourning at the moment. We're after for the end of football season, before the start of cricket. He, of course, is Waleed Ali, trying to find a reason to live.
Well, I just found it, Scott, because you did the boring bit of the show, and now I get to do the exciting bit. How good was the weekend? How amazing was it?
What happened on the weekend?
Just the drama, the tension, the sheer heroism of, well, two grand finals, but particularly the NRL grand final. And let's get a little taste of what Jonathan Thurston did.
It looks to me as though it's taken the steelwork. This is a horror movie.
Wow.
Yeah, some of the highlights of this weekend's NRL grand final.
Hang on. Pep up, Scott. You can't come off the back of that and go, yeah, well, that's some... No! Well, that was huge!
Yeah, look, it was. But to be perfectly honest, I don't even know which day that happened on. So I'm reading very, very carefully off my script here to make sure that I'm not actually getting any of the details wrong.
Fair enough.
But
okay.
No, that's only partly true. Anyway, look, well, it does kind of strike me. What, we've been doing this kind of public conversation thing for coming up to 4 years now. And as I was reflecting on this show, okay, we're talking sport. Obviously, but it does strike me, as I've been kind of thinking about what we've been doing for the last few years, it does strike me that whatever topic we happen to be discussing, it seems to me one of two things is always happening. Firstly, I'm always trying to convince you that politics isn't the only game in town, and that somehow we've got to find the ways and the institutions to recover the art of moral formation. So whatever we're discussing, I'm trying to convince you about that. You, it seems to me, and tell me if I'm wrong, you're trying to convince me that listening to Queen may well just be good for my soul, but also that there's more to sport than commercial interests and mindless entertainment. Now, look, let me be frank. I don't think you're ever going to convince me about Queen. My tastes run in other directions, more like Chopin and Pearl Jam. But...
Oh, you can't see the overlap?
But...
Chopin, Pearl Jam, that equals Queen.
But I'm starting to think that maybe you might just be onto something about sport. And if this weekend's grand finals were anything to go by, it may well be, and please tell me if I'm wrong, that the MCG and Lang Park may well be the moral arenas, the places, the sites for moral formation, the production of certain forms of public virtue that I've been looking for. What do you think?
Yeah. Shut down the universities, shut down the theological colleges. We have our temples. That's enough. I like the thought, and I think there is something to it. I'm glad we finally have the opportunity to thrash this out in a bit more detail. One of the things that frustrates me immensely about the way that people talk about sport and non-sporting enthusiasts, by which I mean not people who don't necessarily like sport but are enthusiastic in their lack of loving of sport, is that I think they separate it from every other sphere of human life and render it trivial when nothing else is rendered trivial. And so by that I mean it becomes separated from culture. I think if you look at sport as being an intrinsic part of culture, and Australia is probably the best case study for this that you could find around the world, if you look at sport as being part of culture, it informs national narratives. It informs local narratives. It informs moral formation in a kind of indirect way, because it takes the place, in so many ways, I think, of theatre. And not to displace theatre, but it performs a similar sort of function. We will, I'm sure, at some point in this conversation have a discussion about whether sports people, athletes, should be or are role models. In some way, that's a very simplistic question, I think, because actually, I prefer to look at them as characters who fulfill different functions within the theatre. Some are villains, some are heroes, but within each sporting contest and within the arc of the drama of a sporting season that culminates in a grand final like that, there are so many values and virtues and even frailties that are embodied in that. So you take Jonathan Thurston in the final moments of the NRL Grand Final. This was a person who had previously lost the ball to the Broncos, which ended up in a try to the Broncos. Then he's a person who played an instrumental role in a miracle try on the last moment. Then he had a shot after the buzzer to win the grand final for them. And even this hero, this immortal who had done everything in the game and maybe the best player we'd ever seen, even at that moment he failed. And then after that he had to pick himself up, focus, and then deliver under even more extraordinary pressure the execution of a not insubstantial skill. There are all kinds of moral's not putting it too high, but all kinds of tests of character.
The word you're looking for there, Waleed, is virtue. And look, this is what really look. I'm not going to pretend to that I know what you're talking about.
Right.
I didn't watch the grand final of the weekend. I was doing other things.
You're the only person in Queensland who wasn't.
I'm sure that's probably the case. But what does strike me, if we just take everything that you just said and you move that out of the sporting arena and put it, for instance, in the domain of moral philosophy, what you have just described, Waleed, is a very, very ancient conception of the way in which morality is formed, the way in which virtues are produced, and the way in which virtues themselves are defined. I mean, this is really interesting to me. That, for instance, we often think of virtues as a kind of purity of character. But if you go back to especially Aristotle, even to some extent before him, Plato, the idea of a virtue is that a virtue is something that's gained by adhering to certain rules of the game. In other words, there are certain practices that are part and parcel of what it means to belong to a particular community, a particular political identity. By doing those practices well with other people, by recognizing the complementarity of other people who are better at some practices than other practices, by all those different things working together, there are certain capabilities and competences that we then pick up, and by then, almost more like an orchestra or like a sporting team, by all of those different competencies working together, we achieve a good. We achieve a good not just in terms of a kind of a final goal, the well-being of the city as a whole, but we also achieve a good that is internal to those practices themselves. And I think this is what's really interesting to me about sport. And look, I'm not quite the sporting illiterate that I make out to be, but I'm pretty damn close. But you know, there are external goods to sport. That good might be winning a grand final. That good might be the success of the team. That good also might be something a bit more prosaic, like ensuring the long-term sustainability of a particular sporting team. You know, funds, funding, whatever.
Right.
But there are also goods that are internal to the game, aren't there? In other words, there are goods that are intrinsic, that it doesn't matter if you win or lose, by playing the game properly, by playing it virtuously in the sense that I was just using virtue, by playing it virtually, you become a better person. You achieve a form of happiness and a good by doing it with others that you could never have achieved on your own. This is a very, very ancient ethical idea, Waleed.
I think, yes. I think we're in danger here, though. A lot of people hear that and immediately say, well, that conception of sport doesn't correspond with what I see. It doesn't correspond with the way that I see the Australian cricket team behaving, or it doesn't correspond with the way that I see the latest booze-filled footballer behaving, whatever it might be. And I think we can explore those things. Mm. But I think the concept that you've identified is important and can be expanded upon, because the virtues may not even necessarily make the individual athlete involved. The virtues of the sport, I mean, may not make the individual athlete involved a better person outside the arena of the sport. But what they can do is put the athlete in a certain position where they will embody a virtue, even if it's not a virtue they can live up to outside the sporting arena. I give you the example of Michael Clarke, for example, captaining the Australian Test team in South Africa in his final test in that series, who cops an unrelenting barrage from Mornay Morkel, who is a fearsome, often violent bowler, South African fast bowler. The broken bones we don't see. The fact that he couldn't sleep that night when he was not out overnight. The fact that he couldn't sleep and had to get up and face it all again the next day without having had any sleep, without being able to grip the bat properly because the broken bones in his arm. All of these sorts of things. But nonetheless, there was a higher cause that he was trying to fight for, and that was the cause of his team. And in the end, he makes 161, I think it was, not out off the top of my head. It's one of the great innings that you will ever see. But the thing that makes it great is not that he scored lots of runs. Lots of people have done that. The thing that made it great was the ability to show that kind of courage and stoicism under adversity. Now, that's a value. Mm. It may not be a value that describes Michael Clarke's life. I don't know. I don't interrogate his private life. I don't particularly care. But it may not be that value. But there's a morality tale there. Yeah. And I put it to you, Scott, if I told that tale, instead of it being a batsman in the theatre of a test match, and I made it a knight in some Shakespearean setting, then suddenly we would be talking about high culture.
Yeah, absolutely.
And suddenly we would be saying, this is the kind of thing that all students should be learning. Why can't we apply that sort of thing to sport? Why can't we recognise sport's capacity to shape moral, national and social narratives?
Okay, you just brought in the word national there, and here's where... Okay. Look, there are certain things that I'm, I suppose, intellectually allergic to.
Okay.
Right up there near the top of the list is using phrases like that is un-Australian or that is un-American or that okay. is as a kind of moral judgment or as a way of saying that something is improper. I mean, one of my problems, for instance, with saying that something is un-Australian, A, it presumes that being quote-unquote Australian is a kind of objective moral category. B, the term itself is wide open to either being used for kind of, you know, politically opportunistic ends. It can become a form of jingoism, but also, you know, to simply evoke something as being Australian can also become something rather visceral. It can be filled with all sorts of overtly or, you know, or implicitly racist sentiment or whatever else.
It carries all the resonances of nationalisms generally.
Yes, it does. That's exactly right. But here's where the very idea of nationalism, the very idea even of patriotism, it's a bit of a complex moral idea, and there is actually a great moral debate about whether or not patriotism can be virtuous. And I think here's where what you just described is a way of understanding potentially patriotism as being a kind of virtue. If patriotism is a robust notion that we have inherited something that was birthed before us, and that we are safeguarding a system of values, a way of conduct in this world to a future generation. In other words, our job in the present is being a custodian to try to, you know, chasten it, to keep it pure, to keep it safe, and then to pass it on beyond us. Then I think patriotism, very much like the kind of tradition of sport that you just described, can really be a description of virtuous behavior. Where patriotism just becomes a kind of uncritical, drum-beating, flag-waving celebration of the present, then I think it really becomes problematic. But every great sports person that you've just described is, you know, there's something kind of historically recognizable about them, aren't there? They really are inheriting something from the past and exemplifying something for the future.
So we've been critiquing nationalism as something that's become increasingly symbolic and not based on a substratum that has any substance to it. And now we're identifying that sport perhaps provides some of those stories, some of those characters, some of those morality tales that might help us build a nationalism of sorts on something that does have that substance. Now, that might be striking people as being way overblown, and I suspect there's some truth in saying it's overblown. But in Australia, I think it's a very significant idea because probably more than any other country I can think of, we do package our national identity, our culture, our presentation of ourselves to the world in sport far more than anything else. We don't do it through military history. We don't do it through the arts. That's why our Olympic team seems to be three times the size of our actual army. There is something about our relationship to sport in our national formation and our national self-consciousness. And that is one of the themes I want to pick up next with our guest. You are on The Minefield. You can leave a comment on our website, by the way, if you want to jump in and have a chat about this. Search for RN The Minefield or tweet us at RN The Minefield.
There are two teams out there. One is playing cricket. The other is making no attempt to do so.
This normally gentle crowd at Adelaide seemed to be on the verge of revolt.
Some of the England players later said that they were sort of working out ways of grabbing a stump to defend themselves when the crowd came swarming over the pickets.
The whole matter of Bodyline was whether the Imperial Masters were cheats or not. That Australians at that time always expected Englishmen to behave like gentlemen. And it suddenly turned out that Englishmen did not behave like gentlemen.
Larwood is faster today than ever. And this slow motion study reveals his action very clearly and bowls to a leg trap to which Bradman falls a victim when he has only scored 8.
All right, I'll concede. You put some moody strings under anything and it sounds epic. That was a clip from the ABC series Bodyline, It's Just Not Cricket. And Bodyline, in some ways, is such a crucial inflection point in our national story, and particularly that relationship that we have and how we define it to the mother country. Gideon Haig knows a thing or two about this and all the other things we've been talking about. He's a journalist, he's an author, he's a sports writer, but sports writer probably doesn't capture quite the breadth of his output. He's been good enough to come in and have a chat to us. Gideon, I know you've been listening. Your reflections? Let's start with Bodyline, actually.
Sure. Yeah.
Is it an important national story?
It's become one. It's one that we've rendered a great deal of significance into. Of course, the relations between Australia and the mother country in the 1930s were rather different to those which apply now. And I sometimes think the constructions of Bodyline have been retrospectively arrived at.
Does that matter?
No, it doesn't, because stories tell us different lessons, tell different and are differently interpreted by different generations. But interestingly, I don't think that the Australian response to Bodyline was quite as monolithic as we're inclined to recall it at some times. It seems that that excerpt starts off with Bill Woodfull's remarks. There are two teams out there, one of them is playing cricket, to Pelham Warner, the MCC manager who'd visited the Australian dressing room after Woodfull had been hit by Larwood during the Test match. Woodfull didn't say those publicly. They were leaked to a newspaper and they caused excruciating embarrassment that an Australian captain would speak in such terms to an England manager. And the telegrams that the Australian Board of Control sent to the MCC saying that that the MCC team was, you know, their actions were being interpreted as unsportsmanlike behaviour, were received with great hostility in England and considerable embarrassment in Australia. So, you know, we like to imagine that it's sort of our version of the Civil War or our sort of cricketing Eureka stockade, but it was a little bit more complex than that.
Sorry, Scott, I was waiting for you to jump all over. But
Well, I mean, look, what does strike me? Look, I'm just trying not to parade my ignorance here, to be perfectly broad. I know a little bit about body lines, but not a huge amount. But I think what is kind of interesting here is that unlike any other nation that I can think of, really, this is Australia's... I mean, the sporting arena has been the way in which Australia defines itself over and against its colonial past and achieves not just a degree of supremacy, but I think, I mean, what really interests me is that the importance here in this particular story about the rules of the game. There was one particular way of conducting themselves on the field that was simply against the rules, but in the rules in kind of a deeper moral sense.
The rules, it wasn't against the rules at all.
Actually, you know what?
No, this picks up a theme. Yes.
This picks up a theme you talk about a lot, Scott. It wasn't against the rules as written down. It was against broader moral understanding, which is one of the things you mourn the loss of.
Which Australian teams were perceived to have previously violated. In fact, one of the English defences of Bodyline was that Australian bowlers, specifically Jack Gregory and Ted McDonald in the 1920-21 series, had bowled with equal hostility at English batsmen, and that when Australians turned around and complained about it, they were squealing. You know, what was sauce for the goose was sauce for the gander. I would say that just in sporting ethics, or the kind of the moral code that's preached by sports, seems to make a good fit with Australian history and Australian tradition. You know, I've always thought that our ethics in Australia are kind of pretty pragmatic, pretty sort of makeshift, ready-made, sort of low-key.
Not highly theorised.
Contradictory. You can find sort of competing threads in sporting morality to express all kinds of beliefs. You know, there's a belief that we often talk about sport as sort of expressing our sort of egalitarian traditions. Everyone plays in the same field, the teams have the same number, they start on the same score. We have unbiased officiation, we have impartial commentary. It sort of reflects a lot of things that we'd like to think we would hold true about Australia more generally. But it's also got threads of authoritarianism, overbearing administrators, an astringent enforcement of the codes of amateurism in the first half of the 20th century. There's a belief that the labourer is worthy of his hire, but there's also a belief that, you know, money isn't everything, that honour and glory have to be involved as well. We've got a partiality to irreverence and a tendency to obedience at the same time. You know, we like that idea of the sporting larrikin, but we also believe in playing by the rules. We've got a reverence for star performers, but we've also got an aversion to show-offs, to show ponies. There's a great desire, a deep-seated desire to win, but there's also often express an affinity for the underdog. There's a belief that the kind of the life of the mind alone is stunting, but there's also a belief in, you know, mens sana in corpore sano. So all these sort of things within sport are held in subtle tension, and I think they live out our own beliefs about morality in everyday life.
Can I pick you up though, Gideon, on the whole issue of amateurism? Sure. Because this is particularly interesting to me. I grew up in the US, and the way in which sporting culture works in the US is really very, very different from here. I mean, to some extent, the sacred function that's often given to sporting heroes here are reserved for soldiers and for the military in US life, especially say from the mid 1970s to the present in the US. You know, sporting heroes are, you know, I don't want to be too crass about this, but they are gods walking among us. They are bigger than ordinary mortals. They are stronger than ordinary mortals. In other words, it's just physical excellence. And one of the things that really strikes someone coming to this country and living here is the extent to which identification or exemplification here is still a very, very important thing. In other words, you need to be able to see something in your sports hero that you yourself can then do. And so the virtue of amateurism seems to be a kind of quality that's been preserved over and against commercial interests. Am I misreading that, or?
No, I think, I mean, Australia's sort of maturation, or the colony's maturation in the mid of the 19th century does sort of coincide with the diffusion of that creed that Disraeli called, you know, muscular Christianity, that's kind of identified with Thomas Arnold and the headmaster of rugby school. There is a strong tradition of, you know, the game's a thing in Australia, a belief that that the contest is worth the candle. At the same time, we've also, and we've often tended to overlook this in our rewriting of sports history, there's a strong spirit of commercial adventurism in the second half of the 19th century. At the same time, the original Australian cricket tours of England were all commercial speculations undertaken by teams as joint stock companies, where the players involved extracted colossal dividends at the end of those tours. And, of course, it was contiguous with a kind of a get-rich-quick society. Sport was a means by which you could participate in the boom economy. You didn't have to find gold. You could strike sporting gold at the same time.
But does that mean that sport becomes reduced to just another industry, just another sphere of endeavour? Does that in any way displace or compromise its role as something that's more morally forming or more nationally forming?
Certainly, as it became more valuable, as it became more popular, there became a desire to sort of impute meanings to it and to purify it, if you like. The establishment in cricket's case of the Board of Control in the first decade of the 20th century sort of is an attempt to take control of the game away from the players who have created this colossal set of economic endowments, and to create a kind of to give cricket a quasi-institutional status.
Does that mean that the argument I'm running is naive? Am I overstating it?
It may be. Well, you may have picked up on one particular thread and oblivious to the fact that there are sort of competing threads raveled around it.
I'm not oblivious to it. I just think that there's a certain thread that's essential.
Sure.
I guess that's kind of what I'm saying. The colonial overlay is interesting. I mean, you see the expression of a counter-colonial identity in West Indian cricket, for example.
Yes, you do. But of course, in Australia, cricket in particular has always expressed both our desire to express allegiance to the mother country and our desire to beat it at the same time.
Another contradiction. Scott, are we any closer to convincing you?
Look, you are. I mean, just listening to the two of you talk, what this does strike me is that really sporting culture is the last remaining honor culture that we have left in this country. I mean, that is, for me, very, especially if you regard, as I do, honor certain forms of authority and certain forms of obedience as essential to virtue, then I think, you know, this is beginning to bring me around.
Too much, Gideon?
I think that that we may have moved on somewhat from this idea of the sportsman being a kind of a role model. My suspicion is that that what's expected now of sportsmen is a kind of a personal neutrality. You needn't be a moral exemplar, but you shouldn't distract us from the simplicity of the contest.
Right.
That's why, you know, an Adam Goods kind of discomforts us, because it makes us aware of things outside the contest, and we don't like that. It was just a game of footy.
Yeah.
What sportsmen should be now is obedient corporate billboards on which we can project our messages.
Ooh, right. Wow. Well, there you go. Okay. Putting us in our place with some more contradiction and nuance. Gideon, thank you so much for coming by.
Pleasure.
Journalist, author, sports writer Gideon Haigh. We're done for the week. Scott, do you like this music?
It's Queen. How did you sneak that in?
We got it in there. We got it. Wonderful rapper. Probably the best sound that's been heard on this show. We'll see you next week. I'll just leave you with this beautiful sound.
On Background Briefing, the sand mining mayor from Port Stephens.
You know, I'm proud of what I've done, and if you're calling me a developer, so be it. Who gives a bugger?
Bruce McKenzie loves to do a deal.
The mayor made an announcement. He stood up and said, oh, good news, the bank guarantee has arrived as cash.
What could possibly go wrong?
Well, it's been like we've been operating under a bit of a boys' club for some time.
Download and listen to this Background Briefing from the RN website anytime.